Sure. I'm Mary Babcock. I'm a Honolulu-based artist, and I teach in the Department of Art and Art History at UH Manoa.
I am Taylor Chang, and I'm the director of the Doris Duke Theater at the Honolulu Museum of Art.
My name is Gay Chan. I'm an artist, and I'm also a colleague of Mary's at the Department of Art and Art History at UH Manoa. I'm also the department chair there.
You know, I was thinking about the art of our time. And, you know, it's just been the theme of a lot of shows over the millennia. And there was a great one recently, I guess 2016, at the Museum of Contemporary Art in L.A. Helen Molesworth put together a show that really contextualized artists and their practice. And that's what I want to talk about for this, our little time together here. The way in which your art practice, your practice as a curator, Taylor, is related to community and the context that you operate in. Would you like to make a general statement about art an artist's responsibility to react or not to context and community? Some people don't feel that there is a responsibility there.
I guess I would say that my responsibility is as a human being, and the vehicle I do that through is my art practice. And
I guess I would like to just kind of put out there, maybe as a clarification, that maybe the typical understanding of art are either performances that happen on stage, or objects and images that are displayed at museums and galleries. And I have a broader definition or understanding of art, which can include any speech or action that is done with intention, thought, and often involves research, trial and error, and refinement. And it could take place in all sorts of spaces or online and shared in different methods. So that, you know, that really broadens out what we understand as artistic practice or who engage in it.
Mm-hmm. And has nothing to do with content.
Well, I think that for me, I think that the practitioner would choose the content that they would like to investigate and to share. You know, and I think that my work for decades, I think, I've been interested in how sociopolitical, how it influences our lives and to, in a way, to imagine a different one. And so my work has taken very different forms, and it evolves based on what I think strategically or tactically might be the most interesting or the most effective. And for the last year, I have become a part of an organization here called Hawaii J20, along with Mary Babcock, and it's an organization that names itself after the day of Trump's inauguration. So we're called Hawaii J20, and we participate as artists, but maybe more importantly, that we bring our experience and skills as artists to the team.
Yeah, I'd maybe like to clarify what I said really briefly, too, about sort of what's the community responsibility of artists. I think I'm probably responding to a ongoing sort of conversation or dialogue that sort of where the question really, the implied question is, do artists have a special responsibility somehow? As an artist, do I have an ethical responsibility to give back or contribute in some way? And I guess really what I was trying to say is I don't hold that role as special to artists. I think all of us as community members, as a member of any group, have a responsibility to be aware, to be to contribute, to be concerned, and that that artists are really no different than anybody else in that. That I personally think we all have a responsibility to participate in the communities we're involved in or we're a part of.
From a curatorial perspective, you know, I see my practice as being the art of not only interpreting content, but also working with community, the art of bringing people together in a physical space. And that inherently has a civic duty. The fact that I work at a physical theater located within a physical museum, and we bring people together in that space to engage with different types of art content, with different types of perspectives, and that the experiences that happen within that space, you know, crafting that experiences or setting the stage so that people in our community can come together and have conversations and have different experiences with art, that there's an art form to that, that I think falls under the curatorial umbrella. And, you know, I'm always trying to think about ways to rethink the theater as a public space. And, you know, what that might mean in the times that we live in, it can evolve and change. But anyways, I see my role as you know, I'm curating a space, and within that space, infinite number of things can happen, and I can do what I can to, you know, control the constellations of what we put together at any given time. But then once you bring people together, you just kind of have to step back and let it happen. Kind of like any artist, you know, you do everything you can, but as soon as you're done, you just have to let it go and you have to step away from it. And then, you know, people take it from there.
I'm so glad it's not my job to get people to leave their homes. But then what strategies have you found actually work?
Yeah. You know, we are in this time where everything's so readily accessible that, you know, it's easy to question, oh, why is it worth my time to leave my house to go see, for instance, a movie on this big screen when I can see it on my phone or on my computer? And, you know, ironically, that kind of this hyper-accessibility makes the social experience, the physical social experience, even more important. And even more, I feel like the more we get inundated with content that we can watch on our phones or on our computers, I think over time, sort of, we're going to start missing and start wanting to have these more social, in-person experiences around art. So I do feel that it's an art house theater's responsibility to keep that alive, to always keep that as an option. Because the experience you have in a room full of people is very different than the experience that you'd have, you know, by yourself on your bed or, you know, on your couch.
Mm. Gay, your work has always had a social focus, a focus of getting people involved in something.
Could I follow up with what Taylor said earlier first? I have to say that Taylor Chang is my current hero.
Oh, no. Thank you so much for saying that.
I keep saying this over and over.
It's such an honor to hear you say that, because I really look up to you.
I just think that she's like the person in Honolulu that's making things happen, that is like engage with the political moment of our time. She brings content and information to us that no one else is doing. You know, no other person is doing. So she is, like, I will keep saying that she's my hero until she maybe screws up. But I have infinite admiration for her. So,
how is she doing this?
Well, the kind of films that she, and the programming that she's done, and just like the current one that's ending tomorrow, I think, called Classified, I have no idea how she's made happen. She's brought like the complete, like, all-star scholars, thinkers and artists on stage together to talk about, you know, how surveillance is working through technology. She's brought Snowden via Skype to have a discussion with them. It's like, how on earth did she do this?
How did you think of it?
I mean, gosh, it wasn't, it's, you know, although I might have been the key person making it all happen, I wasn't alone. You know, it's like connecting with people
and people coming together to help each other. I was helped by a lot of people. I was helped by Ben Wisner. I was helped by all of the, by Trevor Peglin. I was, you know, all the people who, there were many people who came together to make that program possible. And likewise with any program.
How did it start?
With an idea.
What idea?
A word, surveillance.
When?
On a whiteboard.
Yeah.
You know, it starts with an idea. It starts with a conversation. And from there, it's just a matter of how you can creatively pull together your resources, how you can creatively pull people together to realize something, and just being persistent and hopeful and joyful in the process.
Well, there's a way to, you can do surveillance in a boring way, I'm sure.
Yeah.
So something guided this particular program.
Yeah. And, you know, the more I think about it, the curatorial process really is an artistic process. I have no question in that. I mean, you know, I think any artist has this experience where you have an intuition, you have a vague idea, you have a concept, and then you just keep exploring it. And you know, whatever landscape that concept provides you, you just try to explore it in as many different avenues as you can, and then something will realize itself out of that. And you kind of just listen and you keep your eyes open for what materializes in front of you, and then you have to be smart enough to act upon the opportunities that you see coming together. I mean, this is also, I realize I'm talking in vague terms, but you know, all projects have that element of, it just starts with an idea.
Well, but I think that just to talk about the classified program, Taylor has put together a number of programs that do different things. So, like, I think that we all generally think, oh, my God, like, Facebook and Amazon knows everything about me. Google owns everything. Forget it. Just throw up my hands and it's too late. But I think that what the programs that Taylor has put together acknowledge that reality, but then puts in other types of interventions or hope. There are workshops that provide particularly young people of how to engage in this new platform in a way that's proactive, that is not autonomous certainly, but provides them with the skills to maybe change it. Mm-hmm. Like by bringing this panel together, like these are all people who acknowledge the difficulty and challenges of our times. But like Snowden, oh my God, like he have totally stepped out of his comfort zone, did something incredibly frightening, and he did it, you know, and so he exists in like how, like human beings, he shows us human beings that have stepped up and expose something for all of us.
And what's interesting is that that exact description can be applied to any artist who does a creative act. There's always that leap of faith. There's always that risk that you take. And you take that leap, and then you have to creatively make it work. And for the benefit of our local community and our global community. So many things are going through my mind, but like, there's something to be said about, you know, arts plays a role in allowing us to creatively rethink how we interact with the world. And that in and of itself is hopeful. And, you know, when we are bombarded with all of this, you know, all of this crazy stuff that's happening in the world that we may or may not, you know, be concerned about. I mean, when we're, you know, facing really difficult realities in our world, it's hard. It can be very immobilizing. You have no idea how to change things. You feel powerless. And I feel like we've all felt that way. We can decide to sort of stay in that mental state, or we can decide to creatively change that perspective and change our situations. And it takes creativity in order to change, in order to mobilize oneself.
So this kind of brings us back to what Mary was saying, that that artists don't have a special responsibility, but we are special in the sense that the education, the training, the talent, the skills prepares us for a different way of looking at this information and possibly solving these problems than people that are skilled in different ways.
Yes.
And I think that that is not special in terms of better, but special in terms of different.
Well, you two are experienced practitioners of interventions.
Yeah.
What works these days? What has been working in this last year for you?
Mary and I engage in J20 very differently. And I'll say just a little bit about my work, because I think Mary's work there is much more expansive. So I do the back-end work. I basically manage the website, do the infographics, and things like that, just to make information accessible, readable, easy to digest, and pump it out there through social media in different spaces. And so my work is sort of invisible in a sense, but I think very important in keeping things going.
Yeah, it's been a challenging year. For me, this really started on Election Day, not on January 20th. And I had been engaged in a very sort of quietly political practice that was very introspective. And I spent a lot of time alone in my studio working as a way to understand the world. And on January 8th, I mean, on November 8th, I felt my life turned upside down and was really called for a different kind of response, which was almost the extreme opposite, which is to really speak out and speak out loudly about what was happening or what is happening. And at the same time, I think do it in such a way that people would want to join. And so as part of the Art and Shenanigan crew and J20, we've done a lot to try to bring issues to light, but do it through humor, through parody, through the absurdity that, you know, sort of reflecting the absurdity of the world that we're living in right now, and also really sort of hope to help people make the first step of speaking out in any way. Because to me, like, that's like the hardest. Once you do that one time, you realize it's actually sort of fun and empowering. The first time's terrifying, but after that, it's really sort of fun. So that's been a big part, I think, of the Arts and Shenanigans, of really, the fear works for a short term as a very strong motivator, but I think joy works as a much longer motivator, and joy and sort of belonging and connection. And so that's really been, I think, one of the motivating forces for some of the crazy antics we've been doing.
Does it draw people to you, though? I mean, have your ranks been expanding?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's different ways of seeing ranks expanding. Like, one is the number of people who are actually engaging in the actual actions. You know, another is the way in which sort of people turn out for the larger actions. And then there's, like, this sort of anticipation of what are they going to do next that sort of becomes part of the community sort of zeitgeist, I guess. So I feel like our Arts and Shenanigans crew has been really pretty successful at helping sort of political action be alive in this community here.
And I just want to offer a couple of examples, related examples, that, you know, like a lot of organizations, whether corporate or entrepreneurial or nonprofits, they will brand themselves, you know, they by making printing T-shirts and selling them for money-making. So what we've done is a very different version of the same thing. We put out via social media that we want your T-shirts, any color, any design. And I would say over 1,000 of them were just brought to us. They're used T-shirts, some of them brand new. While all of that happening, people are meeting each other and doing something together that may not be direct social activism, but it's like, it's an experience that you don't often get anymore. It's like the old school, like, sewing bee or...
There is activism in having a conversation. Like you can... Like, a simple act of having a conversation with somebody who might have a different perspective than you, maybe opposite end of political spectrum. There's activism embedded within that decision to come together to have a conversation. And And, you know, a lot of times we think of activism as being more violent or more, like, you know, extreme. But, you know, from working in the theater and, you know, seeing all the different types of people from all different ends of the spectrum come into our space and connecting with each other in different ways, that there are so much nuances to those gatherings of people. And so, you know, we need activism on all different ends of the spectrum. We need sort of activism at the big level in terms of marches, but we also need activism on very small, nuanced levels and just interpersonal relationships with each other. And
I think of that show or the series that you did on Indigenous animation.
Yes, yeah, the cultural animation.
Cultural animation.
Yeah,
you know, just the fact that there is something like that, and the fact of what's the emergence of something like that says.
Yes, and that is you know, using art, using a very accessible medium that is animation and film, it's just yet another platform in which to perceive all different types of cultures and perspectives.
But then it's an interest in that and realizing that it could be a wedge, some kind of cultural little tool,
yes,
to create a festival for it,
yes,
cause the conglomeration of these different artists and their work,
yes,
and kind of sets a little stake in the sand.
And animation is a perfect example of something that everyone thinks is being, you know, for kids, or, you know, it's like very innocent. Like, animation has a very innocent quality that we associate with it, so that it makes it easier for people to engage with it. And yet it's because of that, it's arguably one of the best mediums to use as a tool to bring people together to communicate very, you know, difficult things. And animation is very playful. And so, you know, how can we continue to find other mediums or other opportunities, you know, like that, to just bring people together in ways that aren't always so intense or really serious. Mm-hmm. I mean, that it's important to still have that, but there's a dearth of this other sort of avenues of bringing people together.
Now, I have ADHD, so I get bored very easily. So marches are generally so deathly dull to me. But by infusing it with noisemakers, it's completely transformed the experience. And we make noisemakers out of, like, cookie tins and 5-gallon buckets and chopped up broomsticks and stuff like that. And sometimes when that doesn't even happen, you can just bang on a lamppost. And when we just had our last rally, there were these three proper retired ladies banging on the lamppost in front of the state capitol. And it was so magical to me. And they were making beautiful, beautiful music just by with their broomstick and the lamppost. And to me, that is utter joy.
And just kind of drafting off, like, sort of the importance of youthfulness in you know, the work that we do. And I think it came up in the talk that we had this past weekend. But, you know, that all of the revolutions have been started by the young. And it has to do with that, with this kind of youthful perspective of the world.
Which is what was that?
In fact, I feel like I'm quoting Snowden right now. It's the blessing of not being able to know what your limits are, and not being tainted by other people's perspectives, and that tends to come from youth or from those who have a youthful perspective of the world, who are able to consciously protect and utilize naivete in a way that is forward thinking and facing. There's power to that. There's power to not knowing your limits.
You know that one typical chant of marches? Whose streets?
Yeah.
Our streets. Right? So when the ladies are banging on the lamppost, that's what they're doing, but in a very different way, you know, in a much less masculinist way and non-destructive. You know,
Is there another way we could do that, though?
Banging on lampposts?
Yeah. you know, there are many, 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 many people who are never going to do that, mm-hmm. and are looking for a way to express themselves or to weigh in on.
I would imagine those three ladies didn't imagine that they would be banging on lampposts either. And once they heard the resonance that this post made, they were like, oh. It's like that little child discovering her shadow. Mm. It's like, this is my world, and I can affect it. And it's so simple as that, you know?
I had a similar experience, so I must say, watching three women who vowed never to touch a sewing machine make red capes for protest marches, too. You know, it's sort of this sense of, like, I'm going into a territory that's not familiar to me, whether it's like I've never touched a sewing machine or, you know, I've never banged on something before or I've never even talked about this topic before. I mean, I think it's like pushing that edge from where you start mm-hmm. to at some level. You know, we had a lot of pretty interesting conversations making a bunch of aprons, you know, like where people are like already, I mean, it sounds maybe silly, but pushing their limit of addressing this machine, thinking they couldn't do that. And in the middle of that, having some interesting conversations going on. And, you know, I really agree with Taylor. I think those conversations and the storytelling and keeping mm-hmm. sort of dialogue alive is really important as well as the protests. And, yeah.
And kind of drafting on what you were questioning earlier about, you know, for those who might not feel like it's in their personality to be very explicit about their subversiveness. Subversiveness is also really beautiful when no one even knows that you're doing it, but you're doing it anyways. That there are ways to make decisions that might be quiet, and nobody necessarily has to know that you made that decision, but you made that decision.
There's so many needs right now, so there's so many opportunities in terms of how to respond. And then there's times where it's really important for me to remember how to stay centered and grounded and compassionate, and those aren't the same contexts, you know, like mm-hmm. and they're both really important right now, of like different ways to hold on to being present in a world that's changing up and down and all over the place, and truth isn't clear what's what, you know. So well, I think it's really important for us, for me, and I would hope many of us, to speak out right now. I also think one of the very central parts of creative activity is inquiry and understanding, and creating spaces to explore. And sometimes that exploration is quiet and private. And that's really important because it allows a kind of centeredness that allows you then to when you take that step to bang on the pole, that you do it really loud, you know, that it's really clear what matters and what doesn't matter. And so I guess I think there's room for lots of different kinds of reactions, and probably always good to stretch ourselves, but then come back to center too, and then stretch again, you know, so we're not just becoming crazy people.
Beyond that, there's the long-term strategy that needs to be implemented in order to make lasting change. And oftentimes, I mean, I personally worry that my biggest fear is that we're always too short-sighted, that we're always so focused on the immediate danger, and then we put all of our energy to address the immediate danger, and then we lose sight of the longer strategy, and sometimes addressing that longer term strategy takes time, and it takes making small decisions over long periods of time without any celebration. I can't think of an example right now, but I feel like there's enough people out there who have experienced this in some way, shape, or form.
And I think mm-hmm. that helping people get out of their comfort zone is how we get more people to think that a different world is possible. Because mm-hmm. I think comfort zone is to affirm that this is what must be. And, you know, and these baby steps are really baby steps.
Yeah. I think about, you know, Hamilton and how did these people ever get a revolution going? How did they get people out in the street? How would that happen here?
It's interesting how, you know, there, I don't know, maybe you can help me think of examples right now, but it's my brain's in, but it's like a lot of like things that happen on the national level don't necessarily happen the same scale as locally. I remember I had a recent conversation with somebody about the Me Too movement. We see a lot more sort of people on a national level, you know, making the Me Too hashtag, but not that many people locally has made that hashtag. And there's a question like, why is that gap? Why is there that gap?
You're talking about a kind of mainland local lag or what?
Yeah.
Or not?
Yes. No. I am trying to get at that. Like sometimes things resonate on a national level that don't resonate as much here locally. I'm assuming it's a culture difference, but I don't have the answers to why, but there does seem to be that sometimes.
And you try to tune in on that for your programming?
Sure.
Right? Yeah.
Yes. I mean, in fact, for almost every single program, for instance, if we have an African-American film festival, we can't replicate the same African-American film festival that's going to be in New York because we recognize that the issues that we face locally are much different, that our African-American population is much smaller, and that we have a Native Hawaiian population. And those experiences are very different, yet there are alignments. So we have to reframe our programs locally. We can't just copy what's happening nationally. We always have to reframe the conversation locally, but maintain a global perspective. That's the trickiest thing.
Mm-hmm.
But it's also a blessing because kind of going back to what we were talking earlier, it gives us the opportunity to reimagine how you can take a national issue and reshape it in a way that could not only be beneficial locally, but could also be beneficial globally. You know, we have this, yeah, there's no reason why our perspective in Hawaii cannot have a global influence.
Right. And I think that interestingly enough that Hawaii has taken a leadership role in the fight to try and combat some of Trump's most brutal policies, you know, and the Muslim ban, for example, which he calls. And I think the Attorney General's office has been undeniably a leader in fighting with both versions, right?
Mm-hmm.
Quite successfully. And had been insulted for it by Jeff Sessions, like some little island in the Pacific. And I think that when Hawaii J20 organized a rally on the day of Trump's visit, we kind of took the unique situation here of the fight against the ban, and we made this very funny image of and catchphrase, I guess, of Hawaii 3 Trump 0, I guess 3 times, sorry. Like what Kay was talking about, how do you harness the particular ingredients that's here, mm-hmm. and to do it in a way that is not trying to replicate what's happening elsewhere, but do it that's relevant here and speak to the national or
yes.
global conversation.
Are there new strategies or ways of doing this that can make it a little more accessible for people? I don't know what they might be. They might involve social media. You would know about that. Mm-hmm. I mean, holding signs and guerrilla theater is way 60s.
Well, so I have to say that if you check out our website, there are lots of different activities that is being suggested there. There is a team of folks, and not just our group, but it's coming together, many, many groups together. It's called Refuse Trump Tuesday. It's an idea that I think was started with Indivisible, which is a national organization. Every Tuesday for over a year now, folks have been going to all 4 congressional offices and talking with them about the most urgent points of the week. And they have cultivated very deep relationships now with, you know, with most of the Congress representatives, and even though the people say, well, you know, Hawaii is a democratic state, what's the point, why bother, you know, they are human beings, and you cannot forget that they are influenced by other human beings, even though that they were doing it already. Hearing someone say, thank you for doing that, but I want you to do more. Mm-hmm. And Shots has talked about that. Hirono has talked about that. Hanabusa has talked about, you know, acknowledging how these groups have really made a difference in how they engage in their work. So there's that part. And these are not, like, regular activists. Most of them, the great, great, great majority of them have never done this before. We have a page that's just called Quickies, and a suggestion that how you might write, email, or call representatives to state your opinion. We don't, you know, we might offer some guidelines, but it's basically, you know, folks suggesting, here's an idea, you know, and we post it. And so you can do these things at home. There are quite a number of folks who are disabled folks or who are homebound, so that's the only kind of engagement that they can. We also do a lot of, like the Hawaii J20's motto, I guess, is called resist, educate, and organize, maybe not quite in that order.
I'm just wondering, would you ever consider, Taylor, having a program on neo-Nazi views and welcoming
That's
more?
A really great idea. Yeah, of course. I mean, yes. It's just... And I will remember that suggestion and hopefully implement it when the opportunity arises. I mean, there's so many, almost too many options of what one can do curatorially. And I kind of wanted to mention, because I forgot to mention earlier, how, you know, every curatorial decision, no matter who you are, is a deeply political decision. I mean, the politics might be like, you know, so deeply embedded into that decision that you can't really quite tell. But we always have a choice to bring out the politics in our curatorial decisions at any point. It's always there.
And you're mixing showings of films with panel discussions, with workshops. What
yes.
other strategies are
you
might
know,
be available?
You know, I mean,
or do you see on the
we're
horizon?
Always I'm always trying to connect the dots between different sectors of communities and different levers, different layers of conversation. So, within the theater space, you know, engaging as many different community partners and perspectives as possible, engaging with not only film content but live performance, panels, workshops, also engaging with the rest of the Honolulu Museum of Art, you know, the different gallery spaces and the different types of discourses that can happen in those spaces. And so how do you set up an event, for instance, that will bring people together and allow people to discover those connections on their own and then make something out of that? And the more connections you can make between different sectors of the community, the easier it is to mobilize people.
Mm. Could this happen in the art department, Gay, or university? I mean, we know the role they played previously. And
I think that's always, like, the hope. I think that we have so many responsibilities. It's very difficult sometimes to work together with faculty. All of us are in department, right? And we have responsibility in teaching and, you know, governance and all of those things. And I think maybe there's interest in creating a humanities center, and that platform might open up some of those opportunities by bringing people together in different fields and different knowledge base.
I think a place we need to work harder is engaging young people, though. And as a teacher, the sort of common theme I hear all the time is people wanting hope for something forward, that critiquing what is in the now is not where they are. Is that they need to have a reason to believe there's anything that's going to be different. And I don't think they have that right now. Like, I don't think my students feel that there's possibility for change. And so I feel like that is a place, as activists, we need to work harder, is to help people see change that is happening now, to help people see hope that's happening right now, and maybe strategies for surviving periods when that hope's not so obvious. And
wait, now, do we need to agree on where we're going? I mean, it was as though there was an agreement about what this country should be at one time that maybe doesn't exist anymore. I mean, do you feel like your students have an idea of what we should be?
I think they don't want big money to run the world, and they don't see their capacity for action without having big money. And so I think there's a space I mean, I think that's what the arts do, right? Like when we're in a studio and people are working together and they're working on all their different stuff and yet they're having conversations, that's like the seeds of community building. I think we're doing that now, but maybe, I don't know if there's the need to help make that bridge between, you know, that is the long-term plan. Like what we're doing is part of the long-term plan of creating, well, as we say in J20, you know, a space where another Trump can't happen, of creating a space where we actually care about people beyond our political leanings and our immediate family, you know, that that we have the capacity, that we know that we don't have to live in a scarcity model, that we actually could believe education could be free. That's not a radically impossible idea, you know, that healthcare could be provided for people. That's not insanity, that's actually a possibility. And, you know, I think right now the conversations I have is, I think it's a challenge for people to want to step up and face what they fear is their incapacity to make change. And it's a big hurdle.
There's a scarcity of, or let me rephrase this. It's hard to believe in the change when you don't know what it looks like. So, you know, going back to the role the arts plays a role in making visible what that change looks like. I mean, there's a reason why celebrities are major levers in sort of, you know, markers for change, because they're so visible, mm-hmm. because we're trained culturally to look at them for certain standards. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Hollywood doesn't have to be the only realm in which we look to measurements of change, but for what, you know, there can be other realms of visibility. I mean, museums can step up, you know, any creative space can step up. You mentioned Hamilton earlier. We're kind of, I think as human beings, we kind of crave knowing what something looks like in order to believe that it's real. And, you know, social media plays a big role in adding to that visibility for youth of you know, hashtagging Me Too is a form of quantifying in a visible way, you know, a movement. And, you know, marches are hyper-visual and very loud because you can see that. You can't ignore that. And so much of what we fear in terms of big money is invisible. Which kind of makes it so scary. And so, you know, the role that ours play is, gosh, I mean, we're supposed to be the creative ones in society. We should be the ones to, you know, be figuring out what change looks like, except we ourselves are hoping to see it too.
Yeah. Not only what change looks like, but where to look.
Yes.
You know, and I think the Me Too movement has predominantly happened in the media industries or Hollywood.
Yes.
Right. And what about the hotel workers?
Yes.
Right. What about the restaurant workers, where all of this discrimination and harassment happens on a minute by minute basis? And I think that they may, you know, so the media has to look where there are no celebrities talking.
Yes.
And I think that in that sense, media's got to stop chasing the hot button issues all the time. And I'm going to leave that with you. No.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
And then artists, you know, whoever identifies themselves as an artist has a responsibility to make visible what that invisible issue is. You know, it's not just journalists, it's artists too, of any sort of medium.
I'll say ironically too, though, I think the other things artists do all the time is have to have faith in the thing that's not visible at all. Mm-hmm. And usually things look a lot worse before they get better. There's a lot of sort of resurrection that has to happen in the creative process, mm-hmm. and sort of a belief that there is some reason I'm doing this thing and I don't know what it is and other people don't, but my experience over time is to follow that anyway, mm-hmm. and things happen.
How true that is.
That's a really great point.
Ladies, we've got to leave it. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.